The Book Program, presented by Hannah Murray.
Good evening. Welcome to tonight's book show. My first guest is Wendy Holden, a number one best-selling author, as well as a journalist and literary critic. Her career has inspired her heroine, Laura Lake, who works for a glossy magazine. Last of the Summer Moe follows Laura into an exclusive country village where the British elite own weekend retreats. Outsiders are strictly forbidden, but Laura manages to find a way in. Also with us is Graham Simsion. He's the international best-selling author of The Rosie Project and The Rosie Effect. He and fellow author Anne Buist have written Two Steps Forward, a story of midlife and second chances about Zoe, an artist from California, and Martin, an engineer from Yorkshire. Both have ended up walking the Camino de Santiago for very different reasons. Also on tonight's book show is Paul Howarth, who grew up in the UK before moving to Australia in his late 20s. While he lived there, he looked into the history of Australia and the UK and wanted to share the story that is rarely told of the long and brutal reach of British colonial power. His debut novel, Only Killers and Thieves, is a dark western set in 1880s Australia. Finally on tonight's book show is Joan Fallon, who lives in Spain and has written many books set in periods of recent history, like the Spanish Civil War and the Second World War. Her non-fiction book, Daughters of Spain, is based on authentic interviews with a number of Spanish women of all ages and from all walks of life. She joins us back on the book show to discuss her latest novel, The Ring of Flames. It's the third in a series set in 10th century Spain called Al-Andalus. All on tonight's book show on Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Program, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is number one best-selling author Wendy Holden. She was a journalist before becoming an author, and her career has inspired her heroine Laura Lake, who works for a glossy magazine. Wendy's written 10 consecutive Sunday Times top 10 bestsellers. A literary critic, she is chair of this year's Costa Book Awards. She's with us on the book show to talk about her latest sparkling new comedy, Last of the Summer Moe. Welcome to the book show, Wendy.
Thank you for having me. It's very exciting to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you back with us. And I love the title of your new book.
Yeah, it's great, isn't it? Absolutely. Very good summer title, I hope.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think it's important to have a title that instantly draws people in. If you can make people smile as they're browsing the bookshelves, I think that's really important.
Yeah, definitely. Very clever. So you worked as a journalist for many years, didn't you? I mean, you still are, but I mean, Sunday Times, Mail on Sunday, Harper's Bazaar, Tatler. While you were working more in journalism, did you always think that you were going to be writing books one day?
I really wanted to, but I didn't have a plot. When you're working in journalism, you're surrounded by people who are they're all writing books and all talking about writing books. And I always wanted to write a novel, but I felt I didn't really have a plot, which seems in retrospect completely mad, because now I've been writing for so many years, I can see that absolutely everything is potentially a book plot, from a kind of trip to the shops to, you know, a ride on a bus or whatever. But in those days, I think I had more of the idea that, you know, it had to be a sort of fully formed thing that would kind of fall into your head and then you'd write it all up. But now I can see it's much more organic. But yeah, I always wanted to write, but I didn't really think I was going to be able to, or I was never going to be able to come up with a story. And it wasn't until I was working on the Sunday Times and I ended up ghostwriting a column for Tara Palmer Tomkinson that I realised that here was my plot, because it was this kind of Cinderella situation where I was writing this column which was making her very well known and becoming very talked about, because this is in the kind of early days of ghostwriting and, you know, people ghosting people's columns, and not everyone understood that that's what happens, you know, that somebody else actually did the work. And so she became really well known, and I was sort of sitting there in this office in the middle of the night sometimes waiting for her to ring up or trying to get hold of her, and I just thought, this is my plot, this is what I've been looking for. And so that was it, then I was off.
Yeah, brilliant. So tell me a bit more about Laura Lake.
Oh, well, Laura Lake, she's a kind of version of me, I suppose, although she's a bit more sensible than I was and I'm much more sort of switched on. She is a glossy magazine journalist, at the beginning of Last of the Summer Moray, she's finally got the job she really wanted, which is to be the features editor of Society, which is a sort of tat-like magazine, really. But Laura wants to, you know, get really big stories and make some quite important stories and make it more newsy. But she's under pressure not to do that and to make it very frothy and frilly. And in the end, she has to find a new story to keep her job, essentially. And she's completely desperate. And it, during this sort of scratching around for inspiration, that she discovers the existence of an elite village, a really secret elite village in the south of England, where everybody who's anybody lives. But because of the sort of grandeur and power and reach of the inhabitants, for example, one of the locals is the head of MI5, and so he's arranged an internet blackout where so nobody can discover anything about this place, only the people that live there and their friends. But Laura, having detected its existence, wants to find out all about it and do an expose, and this is how she becomes involved in this kind of secret world. So it's a partly mystery, partly rural comedy, and partly a glamorous romp set in this sort of amazing place where everybody is important, everybody's famous, and everybody is stinking rich. So that was great fun.
It sounds like a great place to set a book. You can just let your imagination run wild.
Completely, completely. I mean, and one of the great moments in the book is where Laura managed to infiltrate the pub quiz. And this, because this place is so marvellous in every possible way, all the villagers are, you know, so for example, there's a team that's headed by the local billionaire artist. And then there's a kind of Booker-winning novelist. And then there are various sort of celebrities, actresses, Oscar-winning actresses, you know, sort of Hollywood directors, all heading up their own teams. Not to mention the local cabinet minister and the aforementioned sort of head of MI5 and various legals and just about every single powerful person you can imagine. And they all get together and there's this incredible pub quiz, and it's the most competitive pub quiz on the planet. And there's a terrible moment where it all goes horribly wrong and Laura's implicated right in the middle of it all. But I love quizzes and I love pub quizzes, and I just thought that would just be great. You know, you draw all the people together and show them all, and, you know, it's a great moment in the local gastro pub, because obviously this is a kind of world's poshest pub as well as the world's poshest pub quiz. So that would be really fun.
Oh, I love it. I'm glad you brought that up, because I was going to ask you particularly about that, because I'm also a big fan of pub quizzes. I've hosted one here in Spain for 8 years.
Oh, wow. I wish I could come and do it.
We don't have anyone like that at the pub quiz.
I don't think many of them do, but actually I was at a pub quiz last week. In fact, it's funny how life often imitates art. I mean, just last week I was at a really posh pub quiz in Notting Hill, which just seemed to have all the types of people that I'd written about in Last of the Summer Moray. Yeah, and then the crowning moment was when Michael Gove turned up.
No!
And caused great excitement. So I think it was, you know, clearly, it was just definitely one of the... He didn't do what the cabinet minister in Last of the Summer Moray does, but, I mean, it would have been quite good if you had.
Oh, brilliant. Oh, it's great to know that these things could possibly exist.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's the thing about the kind of novels I write. They are comedies, and they are quite far-fetched in many respects, but I always try to write novels that are just about possible. It's just about possible that places like Great Hoarding, this fictional super elite village, really exist, because of course versions of it certainly exist, and it's just about possible that a pub quiz like that really exists, so, or will exist soon.
Yeah,
so I like to be ahead of the curve.
And the idea that they will all buy 100 pound loaves from the local deli.
Definitely. Oh, absolutely, definitely. Well, I'm sure that's not impossible. I mean, people will buy pretty much anything if they're persuaded that it's posh and glamorous and the thing to do. So absolutely. Yeah, the high street of this village is absolutely full of places like that, unbelievably expensive delis. And actually the bookshop's quite interesting, because that's got a sort of whole history. But the shelves of the bookshop are completely lined with the tomes by all the locals. So you get the Hollywood memoirs of the director and the memoirs of the cabinet minister and the entire oeuvre of the local Booker-winning novelist, including the days when she wasn't doing quite so well and was writing Mills and Boone novels under an assumed name. And there's one of those biscuit shops where the biscuits are all kind of, you know, designer biscuits, and on this particular occasion they've been arranged in a James Bond theme, because one of the people coming to the pub quiz is this actor who's a new James Bond, because he's a friend of the local director. So it's all very, you know, everybody's famous, everybody's glamorous, everybody's completely completely amazing and off the scale. But I just like to make things as fun as possible, really, and as glamorous.
Oh, yeah. So how do they keep the normal folk out?
They keep the normal folk out by, if you hear about the existence of this place and you try and enter it into the search engine, nothing will come up. And if you do, like Laura, happen to crack through and try and book a room at the gastropub, if you're not on the list, which is run by the manager of the local gastropub, and everybody has to give her the names of all their friends and acquaintances, and she checks them all off. People ring up, and if they're not on the list, they don't get the room, they don't get in. So it's sort of police in that way. I mean, I suppose if you did turn up, I mean, it would be quite difficult to keep you out, but you'd soon be cold-shouldered. Basically, if you don't belong, you're out. You couldn't really settle there unless they let you.
Yeah.
But Laura's best friend, she's an international billionaire-ess, but very sweet-natured, and again, completely counterintuitively, because there are quite a lot of sort of horrid people like that, obviously, or one imagines there are, but she's this incredibly sweet-natured girl and very kind. And but anyway, she decides that she wants to move in there. But she's also very, she's called Lulu, and she has this incredible house in Kensington where everything is designer, so the wallpaper has got little Hermes carriages racing all over it, and all her furniture is Burberry, or she's got a carpet, which is designed by Stella McCartney, and everything. It hasn't got a designer logo on it. Even the trees in the garden have got some logos on the leaves. You know, it's just incredibly silly. But she suddenly decides that, you know, she's heard about this place, so she wants to move in, and nothing's going to stop her. So this is ultimately how Laura gets in. So, yeah, it's all completely over the top.
Yeah.
But hopefully really fun and a good summer story.
Oh, it sounds brilliant. So how many books have there been with Laura Lake now?
This is the second.
Okay.
Just the second. Yeah, the first one was called Three Weddings and a Scandal, and that was when Laura was investigating what fashionable weddings were like now, and she discovers that it's not just one particular sort. You know, for example, there are three different weddings she goes to in the book for her story, and one's a kind of Shoreditch trendy wedding where it takes place in a downstairs loo, and everyone's got moustaches, and the food is all kind of retro Ritz crackers, and there were lots of Prince Harry lookalikes turn up just for irony, you know. So it's all really silly. Then there's a castle one, which is more traditional, and in the middle there's a kind of one, sort of Celtic hand fasting under a tree in Wiltshire, where unfortunately the hands are too fast and have to be cut away using someone's dagger, and then everybody sits on dyed hay bales and everyone jumps into the lake afterwards. So it's just, you know, it's really silly. I mean, I think I was researching something else actually, and I came across various wedding magazines. I was looking at various wedding magazines, and I realised that actually weddings had gone into a kind of stratosphere of, they'd gone into kind of mad whirl where, you know, it was all about the style and not really about the substance, and there were so many different ways you could do it, you know, and there literally were stories about brides who spent years picking up odd bottles from gutters in order to, you know, have lots of mismatched stuff on their boho tables, and spent ages the night before the wedding or the weeks before the wedding hand dipping cutlery in kind of zinging colours so it all looked sort of arty.
Oh,
and it just sounded so mad, because I mean, getting married anyway is so exhausting and nerve wracking, and the idea of doing all that style stuff, you know, which ice cream bike, which disco floor, which you know, which of the many thousands of, you know, dresses that you have to changing to throughout the day, or in a kind of flash dancing bridesmaids, and oh god, you know.
I just thought
there was definitely a comedy in that. So Laura investigates modern weddings really in the first outing.
Brilliant. Do you know how many more there's going to be?
Yeah, well, I'm just sort of carrying on, really, seeing how I go. I mean, the next one is set in Scotland, and it's called A View to a Kilt. So that's a very silly title.
Great.
And she gets involved with various crazy things in the Highlands. So I think that would be quite fun.
Well, it works well, doesn't it? Because with a character like Laura, a journalist, you can put her in any situation, can't you?
Exactly. Well, that's right. That's the idea, yeah. So, you know, in the future, she might go down to the Riviera and have a look at what's going on down there. I mean, there's nothing she can't do. She can just go to any glamorous, upbeat, potentially amusing scenario and investigate it, you know, for the amusement of my readers.
Yeah, great idea.
And myself.
Yeah, definitely. So I wanted to ask you about being a literary critic as well, because I know you've done for a while. Do you still enjoy that?
It is really interesting, yeah. It's completely fascinating to see what's being published and what's coming through and who's writing and what works and what doesn't. I think it's quite important, actually. I feel really lucky to have such a direct view on publishing at the moment. There is quite a lot of reading, and I do read every single word of each book, because I always find that at the very beginning of my reviewing career, I have to admit, there was one book I was reading that I was a bit pressed for time and I didn't quite finish it. And so when I'd written the review, the literary editor rang up and said, "Oh yeah, so that book, I see that you quite enjoyed it." I said, "Yeah, no, it was great." And she said, "But you didn't mention the serial killer." I completely missed. That obviously was revealed in the last few pages. So ever since the serial killer moment, I've made sure that I've read every single page, because I really don't want to be in that position again. It was really embarrassing.
Oh, gosh, yeah. So how many books are you reading a week then?
Well, I get sent, I probably do a couple, about one review a month, so that means about three, it probably averages out at a book a week overall, but I mean, they come in three book batches, but that's okay, because I really love reading, and I can read really fast, so it's fine, so I'm quite happy doing that. It's interesting. At the moment, I'm quite worried about, these things come in phases, different subjects come in phases, and so when I was chairing the Judges of the Costa, one of the books I really liked was up for the Costa this year was a book called Reservoir 13, which is about a girl who disappears on holiday in the Peak District, and it's about what happens to how the village reacts to her disappearance. It's not so much about the disappearance, although it is, but you know, not about the nuts and bolts of what happens to her, but what happens to the village after. And it's a really wonderful book. Anyway, I've just received in my latest batch of books from the mail to review another book, which is about someone who's disappeared in the Peak District, and I actually live in the Peak District, so I'm just a bit concerned that it's becoming the kind of, you know, teenage abduction capital of Britain, or seen that way, you know, by novelists. So it's a bit worrying.
Well, yeah, I did an interview recently, actually, with an author who set murders in the Peak District.
Yeah, I mean, what is it?
This seems to be a new thing.
Yeah, exactly. It's not really what we're looking for here. You know, it's a really nice place.
Yes, I'm sure.
So for some reason, it's yeah, exactly. It's having a dark moment in fiction.
Well, you stay with Moe and Summers and things like that.
Exactly. Mine are not set in the Peak District, they're set in sort of seaside villages in Suffolk.
Yeah, perfect.
This latest one.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Well, if people want to get a copy of Last of the Summer Moe, it's out now, and it's by Wendy Holden, who we've been chatting to. Wendy, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray. Talk Radio Europe. The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now is Graham Simsion. He's the international best-selling author of The Rosie Project, The Rosie Effect, and The Best of Adam Sharp. He's with us on the book show to talk about his latest international bestseller, written with Anne Buist. It's called Two Steps Forward, and it's a smart, funny, and romantic journey set in the Camino de Santiago. It's a novel about renewal, physical, psychological, and spiritual. Welcome to the show, Graham.
Thanks, Hannah. You've done all my work for me.
Oh, it's great to have you with us, and great that you've set the book in the Camino de Santiago. Where did you get the idea from?
Well, from walking the Camino de Santiago. We actually walked it from central France through to Santiago de Compostela, and in the first couple of weeks walking, we met just one walker, because we were walking in winter. We met just one walker by day or by night, and he said, you know, if you're both authors, you should write a book, a novel set on the Camino about a love story about old people like you. So that was the inspiration.
Fabulous. So when did you do the walk? How did you find it?
Well, we found it, if I can answer that literally, by spotting a scallop shell symbol on a lamppost. And the scallop shells are the markers, the finger posts, if you like, for the Camino de Santiago in central France. We hadn't expected to find one there. We were thinking it was something that happened only in Spain, and learned that, you know, all over Europe are these scallop shell signs, and if you just find one and start following it, you'll end up in Santiago de Compostela. We thought it was a rather romantic notion, so we decided to do that, and we walked a couple of thousand kilometres, you know, 1,200-odd miles from central France to Santiago. That was in 2011, and with the book in progress, we did a research trip, virtually repeating the journey in 2016.
Gosh, and how did you find the experience of walking such a long way and hardly seeing anyone, as you said?
Well, we didn't see anybody at the beginning because we were in on a feeder route to the Camino. When people talk about the Camino, they talk generally about walking from St. John Pierre de Port through to Santiago de Compostela on the so-called Camino Francés, the French way, which is the most popular route. But, of course, back in the 9th and 10th century when all this started, people didn't all start at that point. They started from their homes and walked down feeder routes to connect at that point. So so we walked, as I say, out of a place in France, which on quite an isolated feeder route for a feeder route. And then as we sort of joined, you know, as the streams joined the rivers and so on, we met more and more people. So it was quite isolated at the beginning, but as you walk on, of course, you meet more people.
And what kind of people did you meet?
Well, look, that's a very interesting question because we've done quite a bit of regular walking, you know, up to 2 or 3 weeks on sort of well-known trails, and it was a very different experience. I think because this is a pilgrimage, even though people might be walking for, you know, just physical reasons and so forth, I think most people who set out to do a walk that takes, you know, 5 or more weeks, in our case it was 3 months, are looking for something. They're looking for something a bit more than exercise. So almost instantly you start talking to people about why they're there, what's the state of their lives and so forth. So it's, I think for anybody doing it, it's a time of reflection.
Mm. And did you both benefit from it in that way?
Look, hugely. I think especially Anne. Anne Buse, my wife, who's my co-author, of course, on Two Steps Forward. Anne was going through a pretty tough time with work and with some things that had happened there and some sort of, she would say, unresolved grief. And she found the walk sort of enormously therapeutic. I think it was a bit more subtle with me, but I'm a guy who spends most of his time living in his head. And you find if you live in your head while you're walking, you end up getting lost or falling over or something. So I became much, much more aware of my physical environment. And, you know, for an author, that's not a bad thing.
Mm. Oh, great. So did you get a similar experience the second time you did it as well, or was it mainly the first?
Look, to be honest, it was mainly the first. And the first time, in fact, we didn't walk the popular Camino Francés. We took an alternative route along the coast, the so-called coastal northern route and the Camino Primitivo. So we had a much more isolated, private sort of experience the first time. The second time we walked the popular Camino Francés, partly because we knew we had a book and we wanted to hear people's stories. So that was a little bit like a rolling party at times, and we thoroughly enjoyed it, but you wouldn't call the experience, for us at least at that time, spiritual.
Mm. And what was the accommodation like? Obviously, with a 5-week walk, you're not walking constantly. Where did you sleep?
Well, yeah, I mean, as I say, for us it was more than 5 weeks. I mean, for us it was 3 months on each occasion because of starting in central France. So we stayed in a mixture of bed and breakfasts and of hostels. Look, there's a recognition that there are a lot of older people now walking, you know, baby boomers and so forth, and a lot of Americans now walking, and they have an expectation of not sleeping in dormitories, cheek by jowl with people snoring. So there's a lot more private rooms available, even within the hostels. So quite often we'd go to a hostel and share our meals and so forth with people in the dormitory, but have the luxury of a private, you know, sometimes quite spartan, but always clean room to retreat to.
Mm, fantastic. So you'd recommend it?
Oh, look, absolutely. I think it's a fantastic experience. But you know, we were talking about it at the bookshop event last night, and somebody said to Anne, who's a psychiatrist by profession, I said, would you recommend it as therapy? And Anne said, well, you've got to make the decision to do it. That's almost the hardest thing to do. That if someone's ready to make the decision to do it, well, you know, they'll make that decision. But yes, look, I think it's a marvellous experience. And if you're just being pragmatic about it, as a holiday, you're getting some exercise, you're eating food, drink, meeting people. I mean, it's a very nice way to go.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell us a bit more about your book, Two Steps Forward, and the characters of Zoe and Martin.
Okay, so we originally envisaged Two Steps Forward as a romantic comedy because I was very steeped in the Rosie Project and all the tropes of romantic comedy at that time. So we imagined two characters who'd be quite different and, you know, typically hate each other to start with and all that changes. So we imagined Martin, who's walking the Camino for the most commercial of reasons. He's invented a cart that he's going to pull behind him instead of a backpack, and he's going to patent this at the end and therefore recover the money that he's lost in a bitter divorce. So this is a man in his 50s, he's a doer Yorkshireman, an engineer, and he's going to walk this Camino to prove that his cart works. And he's planned it like an assault on Everest. He's got everything planned right down. Zoe is a smart woman, but a woman who's very naive about the world outside her own country. So she's obviously American. And she makes a spontaneous decision to walk the Camino because she gets a sign from the universe. It's a very spiritual walk for her. She's recovering from the unexpected death of her husband. So here are these two people walking for entirely different reasons, who will necessarily encounter each other on the route and so on. So we started off thinking of this as a romantic comedy. As the book grew, it actually became much more a story of renewal. And in fact, when we talk to people about it, to our readers, what do they like about the book? The truth is what they like most is the physical journey, just hearing about staying at the hostels, the people you meet, all of that sort of stuff. Then after that, the psychological journey of Zoe and Martin finding some midlife renewal, learning to live in love again, I guess. And thirdly, the romantic comedy, which is now a sort of a subplot.
Mm. Wow. So is it difficult if you have an idea of how you want a book or a story to go, if you realise actually there's something else that has a stronger pull, if you like, and changing direction a little bit? Do you mind that as an author?
Look, I think as an author, most authors I know say that the meaning of their book, what their book is about, isn't something they start off with. They start off to tell a story, to tell it honestly as they can. They may have some idea about what message they're going to get across, but in fact, the real message of the book emerges as you write it. And Anne and I would sit and say, wow, this is really about X, isn't it? Yeah, it is. It's not just about what you read. It's not just about what you discover anew. It's the stuff you go back for. And so on. So I think as an author, you actually welcome that. You say, this is the meaning of the book emerging. And then you sort of go back and underline a little bit.
And how about writing a book together? How does that experience work? Do you have very distinct roles or do you both do everything?
Well, it's a really interesting question because very little fiction is written by more than one person. It's a very individual effort. But Anne and I have always plotted our books together. And we've always been each other's first readers. It was just the draft that we would write individually. So in that sense, it was just one more step forward on what we'd been doing in the past. But basically, Anne took Zoe's voice. I took Martin's voice. And the technical challenge was to make sure that when people read the book, they saw two different voices on the page, but they were not conscious of there being two different authors. I know that's a bit of a subtle distinction, but you'd notice. You don't want to think, oh, Anne wrote that line. You don't want to be aware of the authors at all. You want to be immersed in the story. So that was the thing that was probably the most challenging for us, to make sure that it was a book that read like any other book with two strong voices.
Mm. So did you enjoy becoming Martin, if you like?
Oh, look, I enjoy writing, and so does Anne. So we both enjoyed writing the book. There are always going to be difficult moments, but they survey people and say, what's the best job in the world? And people say the best job in the world is to be a writer. And I think if you can make a living from it, that is true.
Yeah. And how about the fact that film rights have been optioned for this project? And Ellen DeGeneres is going to be involved. That's amazing.
Yeah, our movie agent was on our case as soon as he knew what the book was about, and he just kept wanting to see a draft, and we're saying it's not ready yet, and so forth. But he got to see it well before it was in its final edit shape, and he just grabbed hold of it and whipped it through to Ellen DeGeneres, who he knew was looking for a story of midlife renewal. So he felt that was just an absolute match. And even on what I would have thought was a rather embarrassing early draft, they signed up.
Great. How exciting. So how long it could take?
Look, movie rights are always exciting. We had movie rights for the Rosie Project. I've optioned movie rights for Toni Collette for The Best of Adam Sharp. So I like to look at it like a lotto ticket. You put it in your back pocket, you hope it might come up, but you can't spend your life lying awake wondering what's happening with it.
Mm. Yeah, because these things can literally take years, can't they?
oh, look, the Rosie Project's been 5 years or so already. And, you know, it's been a nice source of income as they've kept the thing going. But I'd just love to see the movie made. But Sony Pictures want to make it with A-list stars, and it's very hard to find the A-list actor to play Rosie, the A-list actor to play Don. They've got to work opposite each other. They've got to be available at the same time. And yeah, it's a challenge.
Yeah. For people who haven't read the Rosie Project, can you just explain a little bit about that?
Sure. The Rosie Project is a story of a socially challenged, and you can read Asperger's syndrome or autism if you like, a socially challenged genetics professor who sets out to find the perfect wife scientifically. And naturally things go wrong from there. So it's a genuine romantic comedy, but I hope, you know, I like to think an intelligent romantic comedy which appeals to men and women equally.
Fantastic. Well, if people want to get a copy of the latest book, it's called Two Steps Forward, and it's by Graham Simsion and Anne Buist. Graham, thank you very much for joining us.
Great talking to you, Hannah.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Paul Howarth. He grew up in the UK before moving to Melbourne in his late 20s. He's now back in the UK with his family. He's with us on the Book Show to talk about his debut novel, Only Killers and Thieves. It's a dark western set in 1880s Australia, a tale of family, guilt, empire and race. Welcome to the Book Show, Paul.
Hi, Hannah. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Great to have you with us. And congratulations, your debut novel.
Thank you so much. Yeah, it's very exciting. It feels like I've waited a long time for this. So for it to be almost here is amazing.
Oh, fantastic. So tell us, presumably living in Australia gave you a bit of inspiration for this book, did it?
Absolutely, yeah. So it wasn't really until I moved to Australia that I started trying to write novels at all, to be honest. When I lived in the UK, I practiced as a lawyer for a few years, and then moved over there, started writing, and at the same time reading about British and Australian history, the colonisation of Australia, the formation of the country, and at the same time travelling as well. And it was that combination of the landscape, the dramatic scenery of the Australian outback, the isolation and everything that comes with it, with what I was reading was, you know, a very dark period in British and Australian history around the formation of the country. Put those two things together and it was just a compelling storyline that I came up with that I wanted to pursue.
So, yeah. So yeah. For people who don't know much about that period of history, can you fill us in, tell us a bit more about that time?
Sure. I mean, it's a fairly common colonial story, but maybe little known in the sense of I think here in the UK and maybe in Europe, we think of Australian colonisation to do with convict settlements and that kind of thing. But in much the same way as the American West was conquered by a displacement of indigenous people, the same happened in Australia too. And what really fascinated me about that period and the inspiration for this book in particular was a group of law enforcement called the Queensland Native Police, who in that colony of Queensland, as it was at the time, were specifically charged with patrolling the frontier and basically enforcing the land rights of white settlers. The terminology they used at the time was the dispersal of Indigenous Australians, which effectively meant slaughter, massacre, and, like I say, displacement. So it was that kind of unique angle on a fairly old story that really drew me in. The Native Police is very unknown. It was kind of buried in the history books because of the nature of the work they did. And what I wanted to write about was how you could be a British or Irish or European settler on the Queensland frontier, living in that world, and somehow try and retain your morality, your integrity, and in the case of the two young brothers who are at the heart of the novel, grow up to still be good men, decent men in that world.
Wow, yeah. Isn't it awful that things like this aren't reported enough? A lot of Brits are very patriotic and like to think of ourselves as a good nation that have done a lot of good in the world. And the history books don't always show that at all, do they?
Of course. Yeah. And I mean, and that was what was quite shocking for me, I suppose, in that, so I was moving to Australia as an immigrant. You know, I'm British by birth. I'm now a dual citizen, so I'm a citizen of both countries. And here I was kind of, just for my own education, really reading about Australian history and being really shocked by what I was reading and the scale of what went on, and the fact that, like you say, it's not particularly widely known or reported, and in the case of the native police, actively buried. You know, there weren't any official records of the work they did. It was all very oblique references to, you know, a successful dispersal of indigenous people or whatever it was, or, you know, they cleared a particular region for grazing, or, you know, those kind of euphemisms that just belied really the truth of what was going on. And as you say, you know, not known here, or indeed in Australia, there's still an awful lot of kind of black holes in the Australian history records too. So it was fascinating, quite shocking, but you know, it enabled me to go back to a time and a place where you can really write a cracking story as well. You know, you can get these two young brothers and send them on a life-changing journey while at the same time tapping into that kind of history that we've just talked about.
So tell us a bit more about the brothers, Tommy and Billy.
Sure. So Tommy's the protagonist of the novel. He's the kind of moral core. He's the eyes through which we see these events unfolding. He's 14 when the novel starts. His older brother, Billy, is 16. Billy considers himself a man just about, and I suppose he is. I mean, back then, in those places, in those times, you grew up very quickly. So they're living on their family's small holding on the edge of the Queensland frontier. And Tommy, really, at the start of the novel, is very innocent. He idolizes his brother. He pretty much follows Billy's lead. Billy's very headstrong. He wants to grow up. He wants to be a man. He wants to better his own father, who is struggling with drought, with poverty. And it's those two different kinds of character traits. Tommy's, as I say, Tommy's a bit more sensitive. He's also a lot more perceptive, and he has a good heart, good instinct, but finds himself dragged along with Billy on this, what turns out to be a quest for revenge. And as the two brothers' character traits pull them in different directions, we see their relationship fracturing as well.
Wow. So how did you come up with the characters? Did you spend quite a lot of time developing them before you started writing the novel, or did that come quite easily?
It came fairly easily, to be honest. I mean, I was always very clear that if I was going to write this kind of a story, I would need a protagonist who could be, as I say, the moral centre of the book. And there's something about children, kind of young adults at that age, in adolescence, where they're very malleable in the sense of their morals, their standing. And it's quite fascinating, I think. During those ages, kind of 14, 15, 16, I think we kind of become the people that we're going to be. And so for Tommy, I just had this idea of a good young boy who was going to go through some very difficult times. And really seeing him develop was a fairly organic process for me. I just kind of instinctively knew him, I suppose, and knew what he would do. So it didn't really need much mapping out beforehand. It was more a case of watching the story and watching his character unfold.
That's good. And How about the structure of the story? I mean, you mentioned obviously that there isn't a lot about this period of history that's well known. Doing the research for the book, was it difficult to find a lot of information?
Well, thankfully, and I've acknowledged this book in the author's note at the back of the novel, there's one particular textbook, history book on the Native Police that has been, from what I can tell anyway, meticulously researched. It's by a historian called Jonathan Richards, and that provided a real basis of just factual information on the Native Police. I was able to look at news articles from the time online and things like that to give me an idea of how they were perceived and how their actions were reported. But in terms of just the specific details, the clothes they wore, the weapons they used, how their rankings were structured and all that kind of thing, that needed to be historically accurate. And thankfully, as I say, there was that one book, and then a few others that helped me with the particulars of the Australian frontier at the time. So again, things like what people ate, what they wore, where they came from, how they found themselves there. It's important, I think, when you're writing this kind of book, to get those details right, because then I think the world kind of comes to life for the reader.
Definitely, absolutely. Yeah. So is this the first of many books, do you think?
I hope so. I hope so. I mean, before this book was accepted for publication, I'd written a few others that didn't quite make it. So it's been a kind of long-held ambition of mine to do this. So I'm hoping that this is the start of a career as an author, because it's the kind of thing that I've wanted to do for years. So it'd be great to keep doing it.
Yeah. Well, best of luck with it all. If people
Thank
want to
so
get
much.
A copy of the book, it's by Paul Howarth, who we've been chatting to today. It's called Only Killers and Thieves. Paul, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now is local author Joan Fallon. She's been with us on the book show a few times over the years. She wrote the non-fiction book Daughters of Spain, which is based on authentic interviews with a number of Spanish women of all ages and from all walks of life. But she's with us on the book show to talk about her latest novel, The Ring of Flames. It's the third part of the Al-Andalus series, and it's set in 10th century Spain. Welcome to the book show, Joan.
Thank you very much, Hannah. It's nice to be invited.
Oh, it's great to have you back with us. How have you been? It's been a few years since we've chatted.
Yes, well, a bit older, a bit greyer, but otherwise I'm fine, thanks. Yes.
Great stuff. So this book at the moment is a trilogy, but there could be another one, is that right?
Yes, and whereas the first three books have all been set in Cordoba, The Ring of Flames actually deals with the sort of demise of Cordoba as the capital of the Umayyad Empire. And so my next book is in Malaga, which for a brief time became the capital of Al-Andalus.
Oh, fantastic. The yes. research for this must be great fun.
Oh, it is, yes. Uh-huh. And it's nice because living so close to Malaga, this time I can, it's easy to get there. It's not a sort of a two-hour drive to get to Cordoba like it was before.
Yeah.
But, it has been fun. We've been to some nice places, read some very interesting books, visited some interesting museums, and so, yeah, it's great.
So take us back to the beginning. Where did the inspiration come from for this Al-Andalus series?
Well, it came actually quite a long time ago. It was in the millennium year when there was an exhibition outside Cordoba at a place called Medina Talsara, which is a ruins now. They had this exhibition of Umayyad art, mostly sent from Damascus. And I just thought it sounded interesting, so we went to have a look. And the exhibition was fine, but I was much more fascinated with the actual site of Medina Talsara. And also by the fact that this city, which had been the most magnificent place in Western Europe at one time, had lasted no more than 70 years. And so I thought, gosh, there must be a story there to write. And I didn't write about it straight away because we'd only just arrived in Spain then, and there's all the settling in to do and knowing, getting to know people and learning the language and all that. So it took a few years, and then I decided that I would really research it and have a go. So that's how it started.
And the first book was called The Shining City.
Yes, because Medina Tal Sara, well, there's some discussion about the meaning of the name. Some say that the caliph called it after his favourite concubine, whose name was Sara. But others say, no, it actually means shining, and Medina means city. So it is literally the shining city. And I think that is a much more realistic reason for the name of the city, because it the descriptions of it, it really would have shone in the sunlight with all the gold and the marble and everything. So,
oh, lovely. So for people who don't know, for people who aren't aware of this part of Spain, explain exactly where you are talking about.
Well, it's about five miles west of Cordoba. So a lot of people have heard of Cordoba. Cordoba's in the northern part of well, not actually Andalusia. From Malaga, you just head north for about 2 hours and you come to the ancient city of Cordoba, which has the famous mosque, of course. Most people know it for the Moorish mosque in the centre, one of the most iconic sort of landmarks in Spain.
And it's beautiful, isn't it? I mean, the city itself is stunning.
Yes, it is. Uh-huh. And to think that this place that's in ruins was actually more beautiful than Cordoba makes you stop and wonder, you know, what happened to it? How did it, in a short space of 70 years, get ruined to reduced to a pile of rubble? And that's what the books actually tell you about.
Mm. So were you able to find out a lot about that history as to why that's the case now?
I did. I found out quite a lot. But to be honest, there's not as much written history about that period as there ought to be. Because although at that time they had, I think, something like 400,000 books in Cordoba, and goodness knows how many hundreds of libraries, most of them were destroyed. So when the Umayyad Empire started to crumble and the Christians and the Berbers were taking over, they destroyed all the books. And so there is actually not as much written history about that period as one would like, which is sad, really.
So have you had to make a bit up, if you like, for your books?
Yeah, well, it's probably sort of half and half. Because I was able to find lots of information that could tell me how people lived, what it was like to be in a city like that, how people dressed, how the soldiers dressed, about the armies and things, and about the caliphs and how they behaved. And then, because it's not a history book, it is a novel, we have a family. And so a family of artisans to start with, and we follow the fortunes of them. And they, in the first book, the son throws all his family in danger because he falls in love with a concubine, belongs to the caliph. And, of course, that is a definite no-no. You know, it's pain of death if you try to get into the harem and all that. And so we follow their fortunes. And then the family certain members of the family follow into individual that you're following books. So it's the son of the main protagonist in the first book becomes a character in the second book, and then his son becomes a character in the third book.
Okay.
So the books are only spread out over a period of about 70, 80 years.
Mm.
So
And was it difficult to come up with the characters and what kind of people they'd be like?
No, not really, because once I had the sort of background and how they would be living and what they'd be doing, then you just let your imagination get to work and create them. And that's really the fun part, because these people come alive for you, you know, and it's and sometimes you feel a bit sad if you're trying to get something horrible to happen to them and you don't really want it to happen to them.
Yes. And is it important to you when you're writing these historical novels to try and, as you're learning yourself, I guess, as you go along, to for people to be able to learn something about a period of history that maybe they didn't know much about beforehand?
Yes. Yeah, I think most people that have read my my books and the feedback I've got from them has been that, yes, they enjoyed the story, but they loved learning about that period, and especially people that live in Spain. You know, they all like to know about the history around them. And so, yes, I keep that part as correct as possible. For example, in The Ring of Flames, one of the characters is a female scribe. And I was going to say she wrote a note on paper, and then I stopped and thought, now hang on, I know paper had been invented by then, but had it actually reached Spain? And so I had to look at that, and it hadn't. So there's all sorts of things. You do your research at the beginning, but you keep on researching, because every time you go to write something, there's a question, you know, would that have, is that true? Would they have had that? Did they have tomatoes? Did they have bananas? You know, you've got to sort of check it all out.
Yes, absolutely. Because it's quite a way back, isn't it? Looking at the 10th century.
Yeah.
I think if you ask most people what they know about the 10th century, they probably wouldn't be able to come up with much.
Well, no, that's absolutely true, and especially in Spain. And I think people know about the Moors, but the focus and the most of the writing seems to be done around Granada and the later period, you know, just before they were expelled from Spain.
Yeah.
And this early part has not been touched so much. At all.
Yes. So you've already mentioned that you're on writing book four at the moment. Do you think there could be more than four?
Well, who knows? Because when I started writing, I didn't intend it to be a trilogy. I was just writing The Shining City. But people said, oh, you know, we would like to know more. What happened to so-and-so and that? And then I thought, well, there is more. There's plenty. I mean, the actual, you know, the facts of what happened to some of these people in the ruling classes, you couldn't make them up. You know, it was so, they were so interesting, and I thought, that's, you know, I'll do another book. And then, of course, I thought, I'll do a third book. And so it's not set out, I didn't plan it as a series, but it has evolved into one.
It's great that there's obviously that much material to refer to.
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm. And your imagination, of course.
Yes.
Well, if people want to get a copy of the latest book, it's called The Ring of Flames, and it's out now, available to buy in the TRE bookshop section on our website, and it's by Joan Fallon, who we've been chatting to. Joan, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Hannah.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.